When I'm looking at the next 12 months of my life, what I do not have on the books and what is impossible for me to have on the books is a trip to Sicily. However, the next best thing to having my own adventure in Sicily was reading Joe Piazza's new novel, The Sicilian Inheritance. It is a vacation in a book. If your vacations were sexy murder mysteries that also dive deep into generational trauma, but not in too heavy of a way, it is the perfect book to take on a plane. It is the perfect book to read next to your public pool while taking breaks to yell at your kids. It is the perfect book to get you out of a reading slump, and it is available now wherever you get books.
As a mom, it often feels impossible to take a minute for yourself. It does. I mean, I close my eyes and I think about meditating. And a baby comes along and bites my freaking toe. Yeah, that happens. My kid bites my foot a lot. It's weird. It's a weird thing that she does. So I hear the word mindfulness a lot, and I think that it's something I should probably do, and it's something that would probably make me feel better. But it also feels like something I don't have time for, something I'm never going to have time for. Today's guest kind of flips the script on mindfulness in ways that I think are really helpful. Catherine Barbish is a clinical psychologist and a mom of four kids. She's also the stay-at-home parent. She chose to be the stay-at-home parent when her fourth kid was a baby. And now she does a lot of writing about how moms can be mindful when being mindful is the last thing that we want to do. She talks about how we can pause, how we can be curious. And we really get into the fact that I think the phrase being present is a big steaming pile of bullshit.
So I'm Catherine Barbish. I am a mom to four kids, a clinical psychologist. I live in Pittsburgh with my husband and my kids, and I am the stay-at-home parent. Over the last couple of years, and I write a newsletter on Substack called Mindful Mom in the Mud.
And I love Mindful Mom in the Mud. Tell us a little bit about what you focus on.
I focus on the mess, hence the mud, of parenting and all of kind of the complicated, sometimes fun, sometimes wonderful, sometimes crappy stuff of being a parent. I bring the perspective of being a clinical psychologist and having done clinical work with families and schools and hospitals, and also being a parent, and how even with all of that professional training, it's still really, really damn hard.
Still really damn hard. Mm-hmm. It just is. How old are your kids?
So I have a toddler, a preschooler, a first grader, and a third grader.
I think we have the same, except I don't have the oldest one.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah. What I love about what you do is that, you know, so much of what we see on the social medias makes parenting look easy and mm-hmm. or gives advice that is not helpful. Not helpful for actual real parents who are living in the world with actual real kids and not Cabbage Patch kids. And so you have very practical advice for parents. Talk to me about your decision to be like, I want to cut through the bullshit. I want to cut through the bullshit and I want to just help parents be normal parents.
Yeah. I mean, I think the decision to really put it out there came from my own experience as a parent. I mean, I was a great parent right before I became a parent. I had all the, like, I'm going to do it this way. I know the good research. I know the evidence-based. And then it was still incredibly hard. And I really started to burn myself out on trying to do all of the right things. And And then I found that a lot of what was out there was still not serving my kids. So three of my kids are neurodivergent. I was finding that, you know, where did we fit? None of this stuff was really matching up. And so I knew that my experience was not unique, that a lot of people feel that way. And so I really want people to feel empowered and confident and find things that are accessible to them within real life.
And what are some of those things that are accessible in real life for actual real parents?
I think, you know, we need tools to empower families how to sift through all of the information out there. I think before we even get to kind of like what to do, you know, what's best for your child, parents need to have skills to kind of to say, this is going to be helpful, or this is something I'm interested in, or this is a priority for our family. How can I go about this? And I don't feel like parents have those tools. Or some parents do, certainly, but I think that's not what's talked about. We're so stuck in the like how to, the like the little details, what to say, what not to say, what to do, what to buy. And I think that we're missing kind of like, where do we go before that? So I feel like there are tools like mindfulness that can be really powerful and helpful. It's not the cure-all. It doesn't make you have childcare. It doesn't make parenting, you know, a breeze, but at least it helps families navigate kind of, what do I want to do? What are the choices available to me and how to move forward? I think equipping families in ways to just be able to get down to kind of, what are our values? What are our needs? Who is this child? Who am I as a parent? That's where you get started. And then you can kind of navigate more of all of these, you know, this fire hose of information that's out there.
It's such a fire hose of information. I mean, everything. I don't think that we were ever meant to consume information like this. And I think about that a lot. There's always been parenting advice, and that is, you know, some people's rebuttal to this. They're like, they're Dr. Spock and What to Expect When You're Expecting have been around forever. And I'm like, yes, but they haven't been on this device that is weirdly attached to our hand all the time, that we stare at in the bathroom, in bed. And that advice is also right next to our work app. And yes. Also right next to how we text our children and call our children. We weren't meant to have this mishmash of a fire hose turned on at us at all times. And I think it's too much for parents. I think it's very overwhelming. And I think meditation is a great idea. So many mothers have said to me, I don't have time to fucking meditate. Okay. They're like, that's really great advice. That's adorable. But I mean, when the hell am I going to do this? And you wrote a post called Tired Parents Can't Meditate on a Mountaintop. And this is true. I don't have time to go to a mountaintop, and I hardly have time to close my eyes.
Yeah.
So what does bringing mindfulness into real-life parenthood actually look like?
Yeah, mindfulness is so popular now, too. So I feel like people, same thing, are getting kind of like all of this different information about mindfulness and what they should or shouldn't do. And I think it's available to all of us. Like, mindfulness is about being present in the moment. And you're not present all the time. That's the other thing. I think people are like, I can't be present all the time. So it's about being present in the moment, being able to see your choices clearly. And I think a lot of people can benefit from seeing where they are right now, that they do pause, that they can take a breath, that they can choose how to respond in a frustrating situation. And so that's where I tell people to start, is start where you are. You know, let's recognize all the things you're doing. And when I wrote that post, I kind of made this list of, hey, this is mindfulness, right? Like, if you stop and pause before you lose your mind, or you take a deep breath, or you step outside and take a deep breath before you, you know, deal with whatever nutty thing is happening in your house, pausing in your car before you enter your home, coming from work, so that you can take a moment and then show up for your kids. it's there. It is accessible to people. I think if we imagine that we have to do 20 minutes of meditation every day in order to be mindful, yeah, that's pretty out of reach. And it's not going to be particularly helpful. Maybe someday, and maybe some people do that. And I think that that is wonderful for them. I think for the majority of us, though, we have to think a little smaller.
We really do. And, you know, when we think about mindfulness, especially on social media, we picture this person sitting down and staring off into a sunset. And this is actually quite funny because I was at a wedding in Mexico this weekend. We were not with the children. It was a very fancy wedding that took place in the middle of the jungle. And at one point I was like, you know what? I am gonna meditate and I'm gonna sit down and stare off into this beautiful jungle. And you know what happened? A stray Mexican street dog came and licked my face. And it just reminded me that if I were home, one of my children would have come up and licked my face. And there is no perfect moment for meditation. And the things that social media shows us about meditation are just big fat lies.
Yes. I mean, the amount of times that I've sat down to meditate and, you know, within minutes, I have someone banging on the door, asking for a snack or needing pants or whatever it is, you know, this happens all the time. And so you have to be kind to yourself and know that you know, if you want to meditate, it's going to be imperfect. If you don't want to meditate, there are, you know, other ways to be mindful throughout your day.
Yes. And I loved your list. You have this great list of presence, awareness, and curiosity and non-judgment with kids. And there's things on there like finding the breath that your body needs before the yell comes out. Sitting in the car one moment longer so you can fully say hello to your kids. I love this next one. I love it. Stopping your task to listen to their giggles. Showing up curious to understand why that math worksheet is the, quote, dumbest in the world. And these are all things that we can do. It's that pause, right? Like you said, we don't have to be mindful all the time. And one, what I really enjoyed about what you wrote is the curiosity. It's not, I don't always love the word present. I like the word curiosity a lot better because I think that's easier in a way because we all want to be curious.
Yeah.
There's so many words that we use that we throw around that I think are bullshit. And I'm going to put present in there in the bullshit bucket right now.
Yes.
Because I like the idea of being curious and not just being curious about your children, but being curious about your own mind and your own emotions.
Yes, absolutely. I think, yes, present at this point, I think, is getting perhaps overused. And it does make it starts to lose its meaning. And then there's like the pressure to be present, right? Then you feel like bad of like, oh, I wasn't present in that moment. I was doing that activity with my kid and I wasn't present. So now I'm not being mindful and I'm not being present. And it's just like a slippery slope to beat ourselves up. And so showing up curious sometimes feels more accessible or more active, right? That's a way that you can show up and kind of really connect with your kid or your loved ones.
Well, and as someone who has a PhD in psychology, what are the benefits of this?
The benefits of mindfulness. There's a lot of good research that's come out that, you know, when people are able to practice mindfulness, they, in general, will report better mood. There might be less rates of depression, anxiety, things like that. I think what gets kind of sold to people about mindfulness and gets translated incorrectly is that people who are mindful are happier, which that is a kind of a misinterpretation of the data that you know, people who practice mindfulness have skills to kind of to navigate the world that will support them and therefore can kind of support them through anxiety and depression and through adversity in life, things like that. But it doesn't mean that they're necessarily happier or that bad things don't happen. You know, I think that that's something we see with a lot of the way that research gets interpreted or communicated in general right now is that, you know, if do mindfulness and you'll be happier. And that's a bad kind of expectation to set up. But it does give you skills to navigate things that are challenging.
Exactly, exactly. And, you know, there's all these books that are actually that are titled, you know, 10% Happier, which is mm-hmm. about mindfulness and meditation. Mm-hmm. And I do think that that is kind of a misnomer in a lot of ways. You know, I think you'll be more present and, like we said, more curious, but not necessarily more joyous.
Mm-hmm.
I think so much of the parenting advice that we get thrown at us on social media centers on that we should be happier all mm-hmm. the time with our children. And I find that very overwhelming.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think any expectation to be happy is kind of a setup to not be happy. So, like, that's a good starting place. The goal should not be happiness because we'll be disappointed. And there are beautiful, joyful moments of parenthood. There is no denying that. There is definitely smiles and laughter and happiness, but that, you know, there's a lot that is really difficult. And we need to find that balance. It doesn't all need to be the dark side of parenthood, but it also doesn't all need to be that it's happy and joyful. And that's what you should be aiming for.
Just the middle of the road.
Yeah.
Just normal life.
Yes.
We are going to take a quick break here, and when we get back, I want to talk a little bit about navigating the overwhelm of parenting information. You have three very helpful reframes for parents approaching this abundance of advice. And we are back. I want to sift through the intense overwhelm of parenting advice. You posted something called "When Does Parenting Advice Feel Good?" Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's the process of how we receive and integrate advice that itches your brain as much as the content does. Mm-hmm. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah. So I itches my brain in particular. I think that this happened when I left my position after my fourth child was born. And so I'm the stay-at-home parent after working full-time with my other three kids. And I'm taking more and more of this parent content in and, you know, applying it in my kind of new role of being at home. And it just kept bugging me about how, who's the messenger and what the messages are and who has access to them and what people kind of take on and own and what people maybe reject and that kind of stuff. Just, I'm so curious about it. And I think that is kind of a helpful, as I said in the beginning, of kind of like, how do we sift through the advice? So it's not even just the advice itself. It's what tools do we have to kind of navigate it? And so that's where that post was coming from, was just like kind of where we hear a lot about the advice that's not helpful. I'm curious about when it works for people. Like, what does it feel like? Who's the messenger? Like, what are the factors that are contributing to that?
I love the phrase "itches my brain," because that's what it feels like a lot of times. Mm-hmm. It does feel like this advice is touching my brain.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it's scratching it.
Yes,
and I do not like that.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it tickles it, and that is mm-hmm. nice. Like your meditation advice, I love your meditation advice.
Mm-hmm.
So you talk a lot about cognitive reframing.
Mm-hmm.
What is that and how can we use it as parents?
Yeah, so cognitive reframing is kind of taking a different perspective on a thought that you're having. So once again, this is a, like a step back from the advice. The content or what the advice says is kind of less important in this instance. It's how are we relating to the advice? And so using cognitive reframing, you know, if you're on social media and you're scrolling and you see something and, you know, it instantly kind of starts to get you stressed out, or it's something you feel like you're not doing well, or you need to act on, you need to make a change of some sort, kind of taking this step back about how am I experiencing this advice and working with kind of the thoughts that are coming up related to the advice. And so that's where the cognitive reframe comes in. How can I kind of think about this differently as opposed to I'm doing something wrong, or, you know, I haven't done that, or I didn't do that. What is, you know, available to me to kind of reframe this? And so those were aimed at kind of common things that I think that we experience when we see parenting information, like when we see someone posting about how to prevent tantrums or things that are really developmentally normal, but sound really scary because we're seeing all of these posts of how to prevent them, how to stop them, and it feels like, oh my gosh, my kid is having a tantrum. Something is bad. Something is wrong. I need to stop this, when it's really, really normal. And so I believe that was one of those in the post of kind of just, if something is posted about a lot, it's usually because it's pretty normal. And so that can be helpful to also kind of bring down the anxiety related to that.
Oh my gosh, I am going through such a tantrum phase right now with my four-year-old. They are intense. I mean, her entire body shakes with fury is what it does. I mean, I'm sometimes worried that she's like, her head's going to explode like a cartoon character in the old Looney Tunes cartoons, because she is just, there's so much going on in there. But I talked to our doctor, right? You know, I'm like, hey, do we need to see someone? And she's like, no, she's four.
Yeah.
She's four. Mm-hmm. It's normal. That's one thing that I think social media does, is it makes us feel like things are not normal.
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. Especially like as you're seeing content, even before your kid gets to that stage, when you're seeing it over and over again, how to prevent picky eating, how to prevent tantrums, you're like, wow, this is something that has to be prevented, right? This is something that I've had, when it's really like, these things are really normal. And we don't really have as much control over them as we want to. So it's not very helpful to kind of gear people up to feel like they're really going to have to conquer this like normal developmental process.
Oh, yeah. No, I have friends who preempted, you know, a lot of plans to try to, quote, fix their children because they had been warned of these things on the social medias. They're like, all right, ADHD is coming. I scheduled her to get tested. And I'm like, you don't even know what she's going to be like, much like tomorrow, much less in 3 months. My kids are entirely different people. Like I said, I've been in Mexico this weekend and I got back and my seven-year-old is speaking in a different intonation. He's a different human. He was also such a jerk, by the way. I need to share this jerky moment with people. And maybe this is my moment where I share too much about my children, and I don't care because I'll tell him that I told the world he did this. We got him the greatest t-shirt ever at the Phoenix airport. It says Taco Cat, spelled backwards, is Taco Cat. And it is a picture of a cat in a taco wearing a sombrero. I love this shirt so much.
It's excellent.
And he just like dead-eye stared me and goes, I don't like tacos and I don't like cats. And I was like, okay. But what other word is the same backwards and forwards? Again, dead eyes. Kayak. Fine. So we gave it to our four-year-old, who is a lot right now. Never been happier. Never been happier. Loves Taco Cat. Thinks she is a Taco Cat. just goes to show you. Set expectations for what's going to happen with your children, and you will be sorely disappointed.
Yes. Yes.
Well, and I think that's a big thing, the expectation gap in parenthood.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that has been set up and really widened so much by social media.
Mm-hmm.
You know, parents didn't have expectations of how things would be as much before. We were looking at people perform this constantly, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And I think that it sets people up not only to compare to what they're seeing, but also to feel like we should have more control in our parenthood than we actually do. And that makes people super anxious and uncomfortable. And the idea that we can control everything, and that if you just do these things, then your kid's going to look like that kid on social media is really a bad setup.
And I think an expectation gap brings us anxiety in everything in life, right?
Mm-hmm.
How can parents kind of manage this when we are seeing all of these images of perfection all of the time? How can we remind ourselves that that is not normal life?
Well, I think that's a good phrase to start with.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
This is not normal life. I've used kind of like, this is not my context, right? Like, that's not me, or that's not my life. That's not my kid. And that can be a helpful like reminder that like, that's a great strategy that someone has for after school time, right? Like they bake with their kids or whatever it is that's like super difficult to get going in your house. And like, that's great, but that's not my context, right? We're all coming, you know, to parenthood, and we're in parenthood with different things and different lives. And we, you know, have to account for our context may be different. And so that is really helpful to kind of remind yourself that like, it's separate. It's not something that is them.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. Now, I want to talk a little bit about your journey to be the primary parent and how you chose to take that on. You didn't do it with your first child. You did it mm-hmm. with your fourth child. Tell me about how you got there.
Yeah. So I don't recommend this. I resigned while I was on maternity leave.
So okay. You know what?
We don't do that.
We all do what we have to do.
Yeah. So I went on maternity leave with my fourth child, and I had every intention of returning to my position. And I had a wonderful job that I loved. I worked at a pediatric medical center. I worked with medical teams and kids who were having surgery, and it was a wonderful job. I loved the families I worked with. I had some leadership roles within my behavioral health department, and so I was managing people. It got to a point where I took that little step back of being on maternity leave and kind of just being like, I don't want to go back. And I was not in a place of burnout. This was, you know, a couple of years after the pandemic, which was total craziness of working in a hospital setting. I had that little bit of space, and I could see that I couldn't go back. And I think everyone, you know, speculated and made their stories of like, oh, she must be opening a private practice, or, you know, has another job set up or something. I had no like grand plan. It just became clear that like it was not going to be sustainable for me. And at the time, my kids were not formally identified as neurodivergent, even though we were moving in that direction, knew other things were going on. And that was a lot too. There was a lot going on at home, and I felt like I needed to be at home so that I could be more intentional. But it wasn't any one thing. It sounds like a nice like linear story, but it wasn't. It was a lot of different factors. I loved my job. luckily there was someone amazing lined up to take on my role. And so that was very hard to kind of feel like I was leaving people in a lurch, but there was someone amazing ready to go. And so that's kind of how I came to be the stay-at-home parent. And at the time I felt like, okay, I'm going to be really intentional. We just need some consistency because we had had, you know, babies coming in the house and pandemic and all these transitions. And it was like, oh, this is going to be like the stabilizing factors. I was going to come home. It was still pretty difficult. And it was super chaotic and kind of sorting out how to support everyone's needs. And, you know, it was an uncomfortable couple of years. It was great. It was the right choice for our family. Absolutely. But it was still really difficult to kind of sort it out. And then in the meantime, I'm kind of at home, just have, you know, these ideas banging around in my head of just like, I have some thoughts about the parentscape out there. And that's what brought me to writing on Substack.
I think that's one thing that's shown as very black and white or one size fits all on social media and in mm-hmm. culture, that there's one way to be the primary parent at home, that it's an easy decision for everyone. And I think there's as many ways to be the parent that's working at home as there are parents in the world.
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. And it's very great. Like I write on Substack. I write while I'm home with my kids, and my youngest will be going to preschool next year. And so that will create an opportunity to do more things and different things. But it's not like this very like clean, like, oh, I left and, you know, I'm a stay at home mom and that's it. Like it's very murky.
It's all very murky. And parenthood is murky, marriages are murky. How has it been for you making that transition to carrying so much more of the, not just the mental load, but also the physical load mm-hmm. as a parent?
Mm-hmm. I mean, it is hard. I think that is where I have used some of the tools that I write about mindfulness and kind of how to care for myself, because without that, I would lose my mind. And I think another like important thing to say is that I also went into therapy, which we need to talk about because people should feel comfortable saying that they went to therapy. And that was a huge support in kind of navigating these transitions and in thinking about kind of how I was going to move forward. So that's really important. And, you know, I think that caring for yourself, no matter whether you're a stay-at-home parent or working parent or whatever, is incredibly important. And I had to figure out how to do that properly. I, you know, had worked really hard for many years. And I realized that, like, I had not been paying attention to really caring for myself and doing the things that I needed to have, you know, to be well.
What are some of the things that you do to care for yourself? Let's leave listeners with that. Tell me what you do for you. And then what is one thing that you think we could all just try today to take care of ourselves a little better?
Mm-hmm. So the things I do, I prioritize movement. I have to move. And once again, like, think small. It doesn't need to be exercise in going to the gym and working intensely. It's a walk outside. It's a short walk. It's stretching. It's standing up if you're sitting down if you're standing. Just moving your body in different ways. So that's really important for me. That's a way that I care for myself. I do meditate. I meditate in these like very brief, imperfect chunks. It's something that I can keep in my routine in the morning. But sometimes it's like for 5 minutes. It is not long. It is imperfect, but I kind of have that placeholder there to sit. Some days it's awful. Like I can't you know, I've got lots of ideas running through my head and I'm like, am I really meditating? And I'm like, well, at least I sat down to have that moment for myself. So, you know, those are things that, and like I said, I think therapy, being connected to the people you love, talking to friends, family, all of those things are ways that we can care for ourselves. I think what people can start today is just think about where you can pause, right? And I know people hate to like hear, take a deep breath. Don't do that. No, you can always pause. That's always available to you before you move forward. And it helps you see the choices clearly that are available to you. And I think that's where you can start. Just how can I pause?
I like bite-sized bits of self-care. And in fact, maybe that's what we should call this episode, bite-sized bits. Because while I would love to go to a 45-minute Pilates class every day and then take a cold plunge, I have been strapped to my desk every day, except for this jaunt to Mexico. But I was still doing interviews there, which was crazy. Because I'm gearing up for this book launch and probably not being as kind to myself as I should be. But I think I know that and I'm trying to remedy it. Also, everyone, buy The Sicilian Inheritance. It's going to be out so freaking soon. Little things I try to do is I'm like, it's okay if you get on the Peloton for 5 minutes, even. That's moving your body. Like just little, I think sometimes we're so trained to think that more is better. And especially with parenting, we just have to think, just try to start with the little things, right?
Yes. Yes.
Oh, I love this conversation. Thank you for being in the mud with me today.
Absolutely.
Will you tell people where they can find you?
They can find me at Mindful in the Mud Substack. I'm on Instagram too as Mindful Mom in the Mud. I don't do much over there. So I would say Substack is the place to come find me.
That is all we have for today. Go try to meditate. I dare you. Also do something nice for yourself and order The Sicilian Inheritance for 19 of your best friends. Honestly, that was really helpful. I love the idea of just trying to be more curious with our children, with our present situation. It reminded me a lot of the talk that we just had with Maggie Jackson. I think these two episodes are really, really beautiful next to each other. I'm off to the Mom 2.0 conference. Get ready for some great content, my friends. This is going to be a wild ride.